Welcome to the Sound Off, episode 99 on the air here this weekend. It is Saturday, February 6th, 2010. I am Solomonster here with you on SEScoops.com and a snowy weekend here on the East Coast, but not everywhere, only in certain places. Just actually read where the Ring of Honor TV tapings tonight in Philadelphia for HDNet have been canceled. They've had about 18 inches of snow in Philly and growing. Not quite as bad here in my part of New York, but nonetheless, if you are on the West Coast or if you are in another country, you are most likely having much better weather than we are here on the East Coast. So wherever you are, hopefully you are safe and warm and listening to this episode right now. Episode 99, yes, I know what that means. We are one episode away from the 100th edition of the Sound Off. And I'll talk about that right now, kind of get that out of the way. I have to be completely honest. I've, you know, been giving it a lot of thought, and you know, I had all these plans to go through every old episode of the Sound Off and kind of screen some of the better ones and chop up a couple of clips, and I'm gonna still try to do that. You know, there's been a couple of episodes I've talked about different things, I've ranted, I've raved, and it would be kind of cool for me to be able to cut up a couple of clips and kind of have them on hand, either play in a in an intro to the show or throughout the show if we end up doing it live, which was the plan and is still the plan right now, but I don't have a date for you. So I cannot commit to next Saturday, the 13th, or Valentine's Day, the 14th. And I believe I may actually have some free time on Monday, the 15th, because a lot of people have off here in the States for President's Day. So I think it's fairly likely that one of those 3 days next weekend will be the 100th episode, but that's not set in stone. So I will say right now that if you're not already following me on Twitter at twitter.com/Solomonster, follow me on there this week, because I won't know until during the week exactly what day the live show, if there is a live show, is going to be. If we do a live show on Blog Talk Radio, I want to put the date out there at least a couple of days in advance so you guys are aware of it. And you can call in, and you know, we'll try to get Noah on the show, Noah Mark. But none of this is set in stone right now. You know, it could very well just turn out to be a normal, wonderful edition of the Sound Off that just so happens to be called Episode 100. So just follow me on my Twitter page. I've been getting a lot of questions about that. I don't have an exact date. I don't yet know when we're going to do it or if I'm just going to do a usual taped show. So stay tuned for that. But we're not quite there yet. We have Royal Rumble thoughts to get to here, some thoughts on Raw from this past Monday night, a couple of other items. So why don't we just start off with the Rumble? I ended the show last week with a prediction. I did predict that Triple H would win the 2010 Royal Rumble in Atlanta, the site of his last Rumble victory in 02. I'm happy to report that I was wrong. Triple H did not win the Royal Rumble, and it was for the better. It was never that I wanted Triple H to win. I just thought that Triple H would win. Big difference. Of course, to the surprise of nobody, the rated R superstar, Edge, making his comeback to WWE. We had known. Now, you know, unlike John Cena a couple years ago, whose surprise return was truly a surprise, a lot of people figured that Edge might be coming back at the Rumble. He had been given clearance to compete. It was just a matter of which one of these weeks was he going to come back, and I think it was handled pretty well. I will say this much. I've been getting a lot of questions because I didn't talk about it too much on my Twitter. You know, what did I think of the Rumble? What did I think of the Rumble match? As a match, this was a Royal Rumble that really did not do much for me. It was not a bad Rumble, but it was not a great Rumble either. It was very much mediocre. It was middle of the road. I look back on it now and I'm a little kinder to it because I know when the pay-per-view went off the air, I wasn't, you know, asking for my money back or anything like that, but I just thought, wow, that was, compared to what we've seen in the past with certain Rumbles that have been good and some Rumbles have been very good, this was not one of those Royal Rumble matches. It just didn't do anything for me, you know. The action moved a little quicker than I would have liked with those 90-second intervals, which were not 90 seconds. They were all over the place. Some were longer, some were shorter. I don't know why they just didn't make it the old-school standard two-minute intervals, because with the time they had left in the pay-per-view, it would have been exactly 1 hour, and even then, you only would have gotten to, like, 10:42 or 10:44 Eastern time, which is about when the pay-per-views go off the air anyway. So I don't know what's up with that, but At no point during the match, or I shouldn't say at no point, maybe at 1 point or 2 points, did we have more than four or five guys in the ring at once. Now, one of the drawbacks to having a battle royal type match is that when you have too many bodies in the ring at once, it gets a little too dangerous. You don't want to have too many people in the ring, but I'm a big fan of having the ring fill up a little bit with guys during the Royal Rumble. And this was a Rumble match when at many different points I turned to my brother and I said, you know, we don't have more than three or four guys in the ring at any moment here. This is kind of ridiculous. It's no different than, you know, a tag team match that breaks down on Raw any given week. You know, let's get some bodies in there. And it never, aside from maybe one or two points, it never really happened. That disappointed me. I looked for that in the Royal Rumble. Starting the Rumble out with Dolph Ziggler and Evan Bourne, you know. I like Evan Bourne. I mean, I'm not knocking the guy, but, you know, two of the weaker 1-2 combos, I think, in Rumble history. In fact, I was listening to another wrestling audio show, and I think somebody had done some research and mentioned that in looking back at all the 1-2 combos in the Royal Rumble going back to 1988, one of the weakest combos that maybe would give competition to Ziggler and Bourne as being the weakest would be from the 2000 Rumble at Madison Square Garden, which started with D'Lo Brown and Grandmaster Sexay. And when I heard that, I thought to myself, how could you possibly rank Dolph Ziggler and Evan Bourne ahead of D'Lo Brown and Grandmaster Sexay? And I'm not even talking so much about talent. I'm just saying, back then in the WWF, D'Lo Brown was a pretty big deal. He was never a world champion, but, you know, D'Lo became a pretty big star around that time period. And Grandmaster Sexay, whatever you think of the guy, he was over like gangbusters as part of that Too Cool act. So, I don't know. I think Dolph Ziggler and Evan Bourne may well have been the weakest opening combo in the history of the Royal Rumble. You know, CM Punk comes out in the Ric Flair spot at number three. I thought maybe he'd go all the way or go to the end and then get dumped. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. But I'm not gonna ride the Triple H hate bandwagon so much. I know Triple H came in and eliminated Punk, but it's not like Triple H came in and threw him out right away. You know, Punk was still in there. He got a little bit of offense in there. He got Triple H up for the go to sleep, and Triple H slipped out and threw him out. I mean, Punk was the star of the Rumble match, aside from Edge, in my opinion. I liked what they did with Punk. He's obviously down a peg or two from when he was world champion, but it's great to see that he's climbing back up. He wasn't knocked down the card and is staying there in mid-card hell. Punk and his Straight Edge Society are getting over. They're a great heel act, and I like what they're doing with him. So that was one part of the Rumble match I very much liked. Now, Shawn Michaels super kicking Triple H out was one of my favorite Rumble moments. I think it happened at the wrong time, if I remember correctly, as Triple H was being super kicked out, the time was ticking down, so the fans almost weren't even paying attention. They were counting down the next entrant, and I think they mistimed that, because if those two guys went head-to-head, face-to-face, even for a moment, and Triple H got super kicked out of the ring at any other point in that match, the crowd would have popped big time, or at least they would have reacted better than they did. But I was happy to see it happen. Shawn Michaels' elimination surprised me. Not that I thought that he would definitely win, because I didn't predict that he would win, but, you know, when he got eliminated, I thought he would go deeper in the match. And to me, you know, he was on the outside, climbed back up on the ring apron, having not touched the floor, and it was just a matter of Batista was trying to knock him off and pry his fingers off the rope, and it almost looked like he accidentally fell. Now, I knew that he didn't accidentally fall because, you know, I've seen enough of this over the years to know kind of what looks like an accident and what doesn't. And my first thought when that happened was not, oh, shit, he didn't mean to fall. It was, you know, what's going to happen now? How is Shawn going to wig out? I was surprised by how many people wrote in and said, do you think it happened by accident? Was Shawn Michaels supposed to win and he really didn't? You know, it's a great testament to Shawn Michaels as a performer that he could really, you know, convince people that, you know, what they're seeing is for real. You know, that Shawn Michaels is living and breathing right now for one reason, and that is to get a shot at The Undertaker at WrestleMania. And I like this because it just is another wrinkle in the story. It just keeps you wondering, well, shit, how the hell is Shawn Michaels going to wiggle his way out of this one now? I mean, this was his last chance. Even Raw the next night, Orton beating him. Shawn does not qualify for the Elimination Chamber for Raw. The question lingers, how will Shawn get that title match or any match, really, whether Undertaker is champion or not, against the Dead Man at WrestleMania. This is the key storyline going into WrestleMania, more so than Bret Hart and Vince McMahon, more so than any of the championship matches that take place, unless it involves Shawn and Undertaker. And I have a feeling Undertaker will lose that belt before then, but the way they've handled this storyline is magnificent. The only thing about it is this, and it strikes me that Shawn Michaels is coming off as such a sympathetic character in this storyline. He's just constantly losing at every turn. Every time he has an opportunity to win a match or to get the Undertaker, he just falls short. He's going out of his mind. He's practically suicidal. And people have to have some level of sympathy for the guy. I mean, all the guy wants is a match with the Undertaker at WrestleMania. And Undertaker said no. Shawn lost the Rumble. He didn't qualify for the Chamber. Vince McMahon said, you're going to have to get it on your own. I'm not going to give it to you. Triple H keeps telling him he's crazy. Just wrestle somebody else. What's the big deal? And Shawn is just hung up on ending the streak. And it makes me wonder, what happens if Shawn doesn't beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania? I mean, it's almost like Shawn has to win that match, but I still would be... I mean, there's no way Shawn Michaels can win that match at WrestleMania. And so, when he loses to The Undertaker, what happens then? Does he just accept it? You know, does he blow his brains out in the middle of the ring? Does he just disappear? I mean, he's probably likely to disappear. You know, Shawn took a break after WrestleMania last year. I think he has been on record as saying he will likely have a few months off again this year, which, again, especially if it turns out to be a world title match, tells you all you need to know about the outcome, because there's no way Shawn Michaels is going to agree to take on a reign as world champion. You know, he's probably going to take a couple months off after WrestleMania. And quite frankly, Undertaker may do so as well. Undertaker is more beaten up than Shawn Michaels is. Undertaker is in really rough shape physically. He just had his knee scoped about a week or so before the Royal Rumble. He was back on TV wrestling within a week after having knee surgery. That is insane. And that doesn't even take into account the hip issues. I mean, that's really what's killing him right now. He's going to need at least one, if not two, hip replacements at some point. He had major hip surgery last year. It was believed that he may have actually had a hip replacement. I don't know that that's true, because I mean, he would have been on the shelf a lot longer than he was. I think what happened was he had some pretty major surgery last year as a prelude to what will be a hip replacement. The way that Undertaker was moving around at the Rumble pay-per-view with Ray, from what I understand, is very much the way he moves around backstage behind the scenes. He was moving around like an old man who was in pain. Normally, he's able to mask it on TV. He's moving around pretty well. I didn't see that at the Rumble pay-per-view, although I thought him and Mysterio had a very good match. I really did. I thought they had maybe the best match of the show. And that's also considering that I thought Christian carried Ezekiel Jackson to a pretty decent match. But I thought Undertaker and Ray had a really good match, too. The finish kind of came out of nowhere, but it was a clean finish. Undertaker beat Ray. It was the right result. There was no screw job with Batista. So, you know what? I'm not going to complain. I thought overall the Rumble pay-per-view was very much middle of the road. And the Rumble match was not even close. It probably wasn't even in my top 10 of favorite Rumble matches. But what they had to do, they did very well. The stuff with Shawn was very well done. Punk shined through early on in that Rumble match. Edge made his big comeback. He looked good for the time that he was in there. He wasn't moving gingerly. He was moving around, giving people spears. He threw out Jericho fairly quickly. I thought maybe they'd drag that out a few more minutes. And then when it came down to John Cena and Edge, what I liked about that was that it was truly at that point unpredictable. I did not want to see, I wanted to see anybody but John Cena win that Royal Rumble. There was no reason for Cena to win. I would have accepted anybody else in that Rumble match as a winner, and I was happy to see Edge sidestep Cena, throw him out, and win the match. It was Edge's first Rumble victory. He's also a King of the Ring winner. He's been a nine-time world champion, multiple-time Intercontinental champion, 11 or 12-time tag team champion. Edge was even a WCW US champion when WCW first was bought out by WWF. Edge is a guy that really has truly now done it all. He's main evented WrestleMania. He may well do so again this year, although I'm not convinced of that. I think a lot can happen between now and then. But, and again, I think that if Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker takes place at WrestleMania, that is the match that should go on last. I don't care if it's not for a title. I understand people think that, well, you know, the title match should always go on last. I don't believe that. I really don't. And the reason I don't believe that is because the titles don't mean what they meant 10 or 15 years ago. 10, 15, 20 years ago, absolutely, WrestleMania should end with a world championship match. But now you have three world titles that really don't mean much. And in my opinion, WrestleMania last year was hurt by the fact that it ended with Triple H and Randy Orton. Nobody gave a shit about that match. If you're listening to this podcast right now, and you actually liked the Triple H-Randy Orton match, and I don't mean just like it, because it wasn't a horrible match. I mean, it was a serviceable wrestling match for what it was, but it died a horrible death in front of that crowd. It had a stupid finish that came out of nowhere. No heat whatsoever. If you really, really liked that match, then you and I have two totally different viewpoints of what wrestling should be in 2010. It was apparent to me when Rock and Hogan fought in 2002. It was apparent to me last year with Taker and Shawn. They know what they're getting themselves into this time. This is the match that has been built up the most and the best so far. This is the match that, if it happens, needs to main event that show. I'm sorry. If they have Edge and Jericho, if they have Bret Hart and Vince McMahon, John Cena and Batista, or a tag match involving those guys, it doesn't matter. If Michaels and Undertaker meet up and hook up at Mania on March 28th, that is the match that needs to go on last, regardless of who wins. I am engrossed in this storyline. It is just every bit as awesome as it was last year. They're handling it completely differently, which is good, because they're not copying everything they did last year, where it's just two guys that want to see who the better man is, and, you know, Undertaker is playing mind games with Shawn, and Shawn is playing mind games with The Undertaker. They could have gone that way. I like the fact that they're handling this in a completely different way. But again, they're making Shawn Michaels a very sympathetic character, and they're making it very difficult to envision a scenario where The Undertaker beats him again, although I just don't see Shawn ending the streak. I mean, you know, a lot of people have talked about this. I probably did too last year around this time, that Shawn Michaels is the last man that needs to break the streak. If anything, they should use a younger guy, or some, even if he's not young, some guy that they have big plans for, who can get really hot off beating The Undertaker, either as a heel or a face. And let's be honest, if you beat Undertaker at Mania, you're gonna be received as a bad guy. But Shawn Michaels may be the exception. I mean, I have to tell you, the fans don't want to see that streak end, but if Shawn Michaels was to beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania, I could see the fans popping big time for that and actually cheering Shawn and not completely turning on him, because they've just built this up so well where you almost accept the fact that, okay, the streak has to end. Shawn has to get his heat back. He's in this storyline, this poor guy. I mean, he's got to beat The Undertaker. And I like what they're doing with it. And if Shawn actually beats him, and I would be stunned if that happened, but if he did, I would be okay with that. And a year ago, I would never have said that, but I would actually be okay with that if it happens. So we'll see. We'll see where they go with it. I'm immensely intrigued. I have a sense of where they may be going with it. We saw on SmackDown on Friday night. I actually caught most of the show last night, which was really good. And, you know, Batista got himself counted out against CM Punk. So Punk qualified for the SmackDown Chamber match. But Batista didn't seem all that bothered by it. And looking at that and looking at what we saw on Raw Monday night, which I'll get to in a second, it looks as though Vince McMahon may have promised Batista a match of some kind at the Chamber pay-per-view. We may be seeing a Shawn Michaels-Batista singles match, with the winner getting Undertaker at WrestleMania. All of these different stories are tying together. So the WrestleMania hype this year has been just light years ahead of where it was last year. I love it. I mean, this is just really, really good stuff the last couple of weeks. Speaking of good stuff, I'll get to the Bret Hart thing in just a moment as well. So those are my general thoughts on the Royal Rumble pay-per-view. Sheamus and Randy Orton, I thought, had the best match they could have, given the fact that you have two heels that they made it very difficult to cheer for. Obviously, the fans were way more into Randy Orton as a babyface, but they constructed the match in such a way where they made it very difficult for you to cheer for Orton, because they didn't want you to make Orton a babyface. Randy Orton does not want to be a babyface. Randy Orton would be a heel for the rest of his life if he had any say in the matter, although I think at some point, probably this year, I think it's just inevitable that Randy Orton is going to get over as a kind of a stone cold type babyface. I don't know that he'll ever be as popular or as big as Austin was, but just, you know, the heel that the fans kind of turn into a babyface, who never actually turns into a babyface officially. I think Orton's that kind of guy, but, you know, they had a, so like I said, they had a good match for what it was supposed to be, but again, it was not a great match. The post-match stuff was way more riveting than the match itself. I thought that was really well done. And even that, they're making it a bit unpredictable in that it almost looks as though we may be in for Rhodes and DiBiase turning on Orton at some point, which again would turn Orton babyface, and I just don't see them doing that. I still think it's a bit of a swerve and that we'll end up seeing Rhodes aligning with Orton, and they'll probably kick DiBiase out, and I think they'll stick with the plan that was the plan before DiBiase's movie came out, and obviously it didn't happen, but I still see Ted DiBiase becoming the babyface in all this, and having a singles match with Orton, or maybe a triple threat with Orton and Rhodes at WrestleMania. I mean, that's how I see this unfolding. I see DiBiase is qualified now for the Elimination Chamber on Raw. Randy Orton is qualified. What kind of problems is that going to cause? I think things may come to a head at the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view later this month. So, you know, the storyline is great. The match with Sheamus and Orton, it was okay. It was an experiment that they tried. You know, John Cena was supposed to face Sheamus. Cena's been having some issues with his neck. They thought he might have had a bulging disc. I know he went in for an MRI within the last week or two, and the MRI came back clean. So, you know, it was probably just a precautionary thing. They probably could have had Cena in that match, but I liked it just because I liked the idea of Orton facing Sheamus just because it was different. The match itself turned out to be nothing special, but I'm glad they did it because another John Cena-Sheamus match, you know, would not have been anything special, and, you know, Cena may well have won the belt back, and I'm glad he didn't, so. Those are my thoughts on the Royal Rumble. 1992 has nothing to worry about. It's still safe and sound as the greatest Rumble of all time. I don't care what anybody else says. Raw the next night, they followed up with a really strong show as far as developing these storylines. They knew they had a pay-per-view to promote. The Elimination Chamber show was less than 3 weeks away from the Rumble. And they didn't waste any time. They had qualifying matches all night long. Edge coming out at the beginning and having his little jaw-jacking with Sheamus back and forth. And I thought Sheamus was really good on the mic. He's really coming into his own, I think. He doesn't seem nervous on his promos. He doesn't stumble or stammer over his words. You know, he's got that thick Irish accent, which makes it a little, I don't want to say it's hard to understand what he's saying. I mean, I understand what he's saying. But he's actually improving, I think, quite a bit. He held his own with Edge. Edge, of course, laid him out with a spear after Sheamus attacked him. And it's good in that it teases the idea of an Edge-Sheamus match. I like that Edge is holding off until after the Chamber pay-per-view to announce who he's going to challenge at WrestleMania because, again, it builds intrigue that way. I don't see them doing Edge and Sheamus, but you know what? After that opening segment, that was a match I actually wanted to see. And it's something that they could do down the road in the future. So I just don't see that happening at WrestleMania. I mentioned earlier, of course, Shawn and Orton was really the only qualifying match of the night, except maybe Big Show and Kofi Kingston, that you really didn't know who was going to win. I mean, it was obvious that Triple H was going to beat Jack Swagger and Cena was going to take care of Cody Rhodes. But Shawn and Orton could have gone either way. And I like that Shawn did his kip up. Orton immediately rolled him up. I don't know why other people don't do that. Shawn Michaels has been doing the same moves for the last 15 years. It's pretty easy to telegraph when that kip up is coming. So, you know, good on Orton for following up on that. DiBiase qualified by beating Mark Henry with a divorce court. So there you go. Your chamber match for Raw is already set up. And Sheamus will defend his championship. I don't know that you had to have Sheamus in there defending the title. In a way, it almost negates the purpose of winning the Rumble, although I get it, you know, that the Rumble gives you that WrestleMania match. But again, I really don't want to see Edge in that last match at Mania. And it's not because I dislike Edge. It's just because I really think that Shawn and Undertaker should end the show. I really do. And, I guess you can be in the main event of WrestleMania, but not be the last match. But, But not really. I mean, whatever that last match is, that's really the main event, let's be honest. What else did we see on Raw? Guest host, William Shatner. Loved it. I loved William Shatner. Complete night and day from his appearance at the Hall of Fame a couple of years ago when he inducted Jerry Lawler. He looked nervous. He was sweating bullets up there. He, you know, calls himself a fan. It's obvious to me that he's not a fan who watches TV all that much because, you know, he just didn't come off to me that way when he was at the Hall of Fame. Is he a real fan? I don't know if he is or not. Obviously, he has a certain level of respect for wrestlers since he's made a couple of appearances over the years. But I thought the way they used him on Monday was perfect. We didn't get too much William Shatner. We got just enough to justify him being there. That little commercial with him doing the spoken word versions of the WWE entrance music was awesome. I could have sat there for another half hour, quite frankly. I would have loved for him to go into the archives and sing, you know, Big Boss Man's theme music or Hulk Hogan's Real America. Just go through all the old school wrestling themes. Fabulous Rougeau Brothers, Quebecers, Demolition. I can go on and on. Jive So Bro. Now that would have been priceless right there. William Shatner doing the spoken word version in his voice of the Slickster doing Jive Soul Bro. I'm gonna suggest that to them. I'm gonna email them. But that was really cool stuff, something that actually made me laugh for once. And the Raw Negotiator thing, it was corny, it was campy when he made that triple threat match backstage. But again, I like Shatner. He was one of the better guest hosts that they've had. Maybe even top five, quite frankly. We get a big tag team triple threat match on Raw next week. CM Punk and Luke Gallows are going to finally get their unified tag team title match that they did not get on SmackDown last week. They're going to compete against The Miz and The Big Show and DX for the tag belts. I'd be shocked if DX walks out with those belts. Shawn is spiraling out of control. He obviously does not give a shit about being tag team champion. He is consumed with The Undertaker at this point. They're teasing dissension. They're teasing... I don't want to say a breakup. I mean, it's possible they could break up DX, but there's something going on there. And I don't know if it'll be Punk and Gallows that get the belts. It could just as easily be Big Show and Miz. I don't care who wins the belts, quite frankly, as long as they get them off DX. Because, you know, it doesn't serve any purpose. I mean, who is DX going to defend those belts against beyond next week? If they beat Gallows and Punk and they beat Miz and Big Show... You know, Jericho and Big Show are not a team anymore. Legacy, I'm so tired of DX Legacy matches. Who else is there? There is nobody else. I mean, there's the Hart Dynasty, and they're obviously not interested in putting that match together, so hopefully they will drop the belts next week. The only other thing on Raw I want to talk about, you know, Kofi Kingston had a pretty bad botch. I thought he recovered pretty nicely from it. He almost slipped off the top rope. In that match against Big Show. That finish was stupid. I laughed when Big Show kept screaming about how it was an accident because, you know what? The way they booked that whole segment, I felt sorry for the Big Show. I really did. I felt sorry for the heel. It was obvious he punched the referee by accident. It was an accident. It was clear to anybody watching that he didn't mean to hit the referee in the face. So why disqualify the poor bastard? You know? He didn't attack the referee after the match. He walked away. He was complaining. He was downtrodden. I felt badly for the guy. And it makes me think that perhaps that's an indicator that him and Miz may win those belts, may win the tag belts, because now, you know, Big Show has no spot in the chamber match, and so what else is he going to do? I don't know if he'll defend the belts with Miz, but, you know, when you think about it like that, maybe Miz and Big Show will win those belts on Monday Night. Punk can win the belts with Gallows, but Punk is already in the chamber match, so his focus is the World Heavyweight Championship, not so much the tag team belts. And then there's the Bret Hart Vince McMahon segment. This was really good stuff. Bret looked a little bit better even than he did last time. He obviously dyed his hair darker. It looked like maybe he shed a little bit of the weight that he was showing on the 4th of January, but it was hard to say because, I guess at the end his jacket did come off, but, he was wearing his jacket most of the time. What made it noticeable last time was that he took his jacket off and he was standing there and you could see he had a little belly drooping over, but, I know he's been working like a madman to try to get into shape, so, you know, good for him. He looked a little bit better. His promo was great. I mean, with Bret Hart, you know the kind of promo you're going to get. If you're not a fan of Bret Hart to begin with, you're not going to be a fan of his no matter what. The thing about Bret Hart's promos, it feels real. It doesn't feel like he's reading a script. I mean, sometimes it does. You know, every time somebody says WWE Universe, I want to gag. You know? Last night I was watching SmackDown, and Mickie James came out, and she was talking about her World Championship women's win at the Royal Rumble when she beat Michelle McCool, and Beth Phoenix came out. And Beth Phoenix cut this promo on Mickie James that the hairs on the back of my neck were standing up. Why? It wasn't a bad promo. It had nothing to do with Beth. But Beth cut a promo that completely sounded scripted. And then she had to stick that WWE Universe term in there. And just the way that she did it, it sounded so forced and so rehearsed and so fake. It just, it makes my skin crawl. I can't stand that. I mean, I understand they're trying to brand themselves and they like the term. That's fine. But to force every single person to include it in every single interview they do, because they tell everybody to put it in there at least once. I mean, everybody has said it. The Miz has said it in every promo that he's done. Beth Phoenix said it last night. Bret Hart had to say it on January 4th. I'm so sick of the WWE Universe term. I mean, that's like the NFL. If they started, you know, telling all their people and the announcers, the networks told their announcers, look, you know, you are to refer to these people not as fans. They're not football fans. It's the NFL galaxy. These are inhabitants of the NFL galaxy. You know how retarded that would sound? You know the backlash, the comedy that would ensue from something like that? But, of course, wrestling falls under the radar, so it doesn't matter. Anyway, that's just little things like that that annoy me. But, anyway, back to Bret Hart. His promo was really, really good. And I knew that he was going to, at some point, bring up the stroke that he suffered back in 2002. And he brought it up on Monday night. And, again, it fits into that storyline so well. You know, here's a guy who came back with the best of intentions. We all thought he was coming back on Raw, and he was going to give Shawn Michaels a piece of his mind, maybe even beat him up. That didn't happen. I would have booked it a little bit differently, but whatever. Bret's goal in coming back in storyline was to truly bury the hatchet. He was ready to put this behind him. He came with the best of intentions. And what did Vince McMahon do? Vince McMahon screwed him again by kicking him in the balls. They keep saying in the gut. It may have actually been above the belt, but it looked to me like he got kicked in the balls. So I'll just say that he got kicked in the nuts. And so Bret comes back and he says how he felt all pathetic on his knees, laying in a heap, and tells people about the stroke that he suffered and how he felt pathetic, and he promised himself he would never feel that way again. But of course, Vince McMahon changed all that when he kicked him in the crotch. So now Bret Hart, who wanted to be the nice guy last time, a month ago, and bury the hatchet, now, not so much. Now he lets Vince McMahon know what he really thinks about him. He says, in terms of being a liar, Vince McMahon truly is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be. And what I liked also about Bret's promo is the usage of the word ass, because I can't remember the last time anybody in a WWE TV promo used the word ass because of the PG direction. I mean, ass is one of those words on the banned list. So, I don't know if Bret just was able to ad-lib some of his promo. I mean, it's not like he's going to get in trouble for it, but, or if that, they actually scripted it that way to make it seem a little more real. But, yeah, he used it two different times. He said that, I think he told Vince McMahon to get his ass out here, and then when he did, at the end of his promo, he said, you know, Vince a couple weeks ago came out and described me as being a chewed up piece of gum, and he said, well, you know, this chewed up piece of gum has a little more flavor, just enough flavor left in it to kick your ass, and everybody popped big, and I like that. And then Vince McMahon had his little retort, and I thought Vince cut a great promo too. I don't know that I would have been making funny faces like he was, although I laughed. When he did that droopy dog face, I laughed. But I thought Vince's promo was every bit as good as Bret's, if not more so. The back and forth between these two was awesome. They really did an awesome job with it, and when I have a bone to pick with Michael Cole, surprise, surprise. At the end of that promo, when Vince McMahon said that he wasn't going to induct Stu Hart into the Hall of Fame because he didn't deserve it, and Bret started wailing away on him, first of all, I wouldn't have had them come to blows like this. Not yet, anyway, but it was still a big moment, and I popped for it. But what I didn't like was that Michael Cole sounded like he was comatose when he was announcing this. So go back on YouTube and watch a clip of the end of the segment. When Bret starts beating up Vince McMahon, okay, this is the big moment where Vince McMahon is being beaten up in the middle of the ring by Bret Hart. This is a moment that is 12 years in the making, okay? And really, everybody is waiting for the sharpshooter, which hopefully they will hold off on that until WrestleMania. But he just pulls Vince's suit jacket over his head and hockey style just starts beating the shit out of him. And I'm listening, and I hear Michael Cole speaking in his normal speaking voice, saying, 12 years. It's been 12 years. He sounded like he was in a fucking coma. I wanted to cry at that point because, you know, Jim Ross many times would go a little over the top. I mean, let's be honest. There were many times, actually, when Jim Ross would be announcing something, even if it was just the go-home show to a pay-per-view, and he would practically orgasm on the air, and I thought, okay, calm down. You know, that's a little too much. But still, when there was a match, if there was a show, if there was something to promote and give a hard sell to, if there was a big-time, monumental, memorable wrestling moment, if I had to pick which announcer I would want in the announce booth for it, it would be Jim Ross. And it was that moment, maybe more so than any other moment since Jim Ross was removed from the Raw announce booth in June of 08, that I really, really missed Jim Ross. Because Jim Ross has a connection, first of all, to this. I mean, Jim Ross lived through all this, the whole Montreal thing and everything, and so he has a personal connection that Michael Cole just doesn't. I mean, Michael Cole started in the WWF in 1997, so, like, with Montreal, technically he was there, but I don't look at Michael Cole as having a connection to that whole thing. Jim Ross had a personal connection to it, and Jim Ross would have put this over as being one of the biggest moments in the last decade of Raw. Michael Cole was awful. He was fucking terrible during this segment. He ruined it. I shouldn't say he ruined it because I still loved it, but he almost ruined it for me. It would have been better for the announcers, quite frankly, to just lay out, like Vince McMahon has them do many times, and just let the action speak for itself, and just listen to the crowd roar, because they were, when he was beating the piss out of Vince. Michael Cole completely mishandled that segment right there. I don't know, I'm not saying he should have just screamed for the sake of screaming, but he could have elevated his voice. He's an announcer. He is a professional, or so they say. That is a moment that warranted a different type of commentary, and instead he treated it like it was any other fucking moment on any other Raw show. And that just pissed me off. And I think sometimes when people write into me and they say, Michael Cole sucks, I wish Michael Cole would die, I wish Michael Cole would be hit by a train, I say to them, okay, you know, that's a little over the top. I don't wish death on Michael Cole, I don't wish ill will towards him or his family. I'm being honest here. As a wrestling announcer, he's terrible. He may be better than he is on TV. In reality, he may be a lot better than he shows because Vince McMahon overproduces his announcers. Even so, Vince McMahon, I'm sure, did not tell Michael Cole, sit there and pretend like you're a corpse. So, anyway, the way that that was handled was just awful. It was just terrible. It really would have felt a lot more special if you had somebody else not named Michael Cole sitting at the announce table. So anyway, where was I? Brett has Vince on the ground, and he picks up his legs, and the crowd roars because they know what's coming up next. I like that Vince's shoes started coming off, so Brett just took it off and threw it at him. That was cool. So he puts one leg in. He's starting to put him in the sharpshooter, which, again, I sincerely hope that that's the big moment they hold off until WrestleMania 4, because that's really what it's all about. And I've said before, my only concern is that if, you know, when the time comes that Brett puts him in the sharpshooter, that he doesn't fall over. I know Brett's balance isn't quite what it used to be. He's a little bit older. He hasn't probably put anybody in the sharpshooter in years. And, you know, Vince McMahon is not a trained professional. And if he doesn't turn over, you know, just the right time, it would be embarrassing for Brett to put him in a sharpshooter, turn over, and then fall down. But as he's going to put Vince in the sharpshooter, out comes Batista. And this was sincerely surprising because Batista was not somebody you would expect to show up, mainly because he's a SmackDown superstar, but as we have been told and as we've seen numerous times, the brand split really doesn't mean jack shit. So out comes Batista, and I will say this, I was scared at that moment because when he grabbed Bret Hart, it looked like he was putting him in position for the powerbomb, for the Batista bomb, and I thought, oh my God, they are not going to have Bret take a powerbomb. And really all he was doing, he was pulling Brett's jacket over his head, much like Brett did with Vince, and giving him punches to the side and punches to the head, presumably to the head, but although he never actually hit him in the head. Reason for that is because, again, Brett simply cannot take bumps. He cannot take blows to the head. You know, even worked punches to the head, he just can't do it. He's not physically in a position to take those types of shots. And, you know, if somebody doesn't pull their punches and one accidentally hits him, I mean, it could be disaster for him. So, they really have to do a good job of protecting Brett. And that leads to the scenario that we're left with going off the air. A lot of people have been asking me, Solomonster, does this mean we're getting a tag match? You know, people just livid at the idea that John Cena may be inserted into this Bret Hart and Vince McMahon storyline. And I've given it some thought. You know, at first I thought to myself, oh my God, they're going to do a tag match. And I think that may be the direction they go in, but we don't know that for sure. You know, the two storylines may briefly overlap because they need a reason for John Cena to feud with Batista if they're going to have a match at WrestleMania. They could do this and still have singles matches with Bret versus Vince in a street fight and Cena versus Batista, but it looks to me like they may be going for a tag match, and that could be for any number of reasons, because I know that wasn't the original plan. It could be because they just realized that Bret really just can't do anything, and so for his sake, they're going to put him in a tag match, or maybe they just decided that, you know, here's a way to merge the two, because on their own, I mean, Cena and Batista could have a really good match. But, you know, Brett and Vince, probably not so much. So let's just put the two of them together and make it a tag match. The more I think about this, I really don't have a problem with that. I really don't. Because it takes the load off Brett having to do much. You know, Brett could still get his hands on Vince. He could still put Vince in the sharpshooter. Brett could still win the match. I don't know if, you know, Brett's going to just wear street clothes to WrestleMania, if he's going to actually wear the pink tights. I guess a lot of that depends on if he can get himself in good enough shape for that. But if that's the direction they're going to go in for WrestleMania, I'm okay with that. I'm actually intrigued by it. I am intrigued by the idea of Batista as Vince McMahon's hired assassin. I don't think they're going to go in that direction, just kind of making him the bodyguard for Vince. Although I think Big Dave would fit that role perfectly. I mean, coming out with, you know, the sharp clothing and the big shades on, watching Vince's back because Vince doesn't want to get beaten up again by Bret Hart or John Cena. I think that would be awesome. Although I think it has more to do with Batista just doing Vince a favor because Batista, in return, wants a shot at The Undertaker. And if he doesn't get that, I don't know how happy Big Dave is going to be. But what you didn't see when Raw went off the air, and they actually showed it on SmackDown last night. They showed this exclusive footage from off the air when John Cena did come out to rescue Bret. You know, I said on my Twitter page after Raw went off the air, I said, I guess Bret Hart doesn't have any friends because nobody came out to save him when Batista held him and Vince spat in his face and all that. But John Cena did eventually come out. He cleaned house, and Batista actually came back into the ring and beat up John Cena, hit him with the steel ring steps, and then he actually gave him a spine buster, I think, or a power slam on the steel steps. I don't know how smart that was for a guy that has a bulging disc in his neck, but all I know is that nobody knows for sure what they're going to do. Are they going to do singles matches? Are they going to make it a tag match? Are they going to do Batista versus Cena with Bret in Cena's corner and Vince in Batista's corner? And maybe, you know, if Cena wins, then Bret gets 5 minutes alone in the ring with Vince or something like that. To me, that would be the one scenario I would like the least, because I really want Bret to be involved in a match of some kind, even if it's a tag match. But any one of those scenarios to me is intriguing. And it makes you actually care about John Cena. This may be the only thing that makes me care about John Cena. The fans were chanting his name. Yeah, it was mostly kids, but, you know, the lasting vision and audio at the end of that show was people chanting for John Cena. They wanted to see Cena came out and save Bret Hart. I'm okay with that. And I'm intrigued to see where they go next with this. The road to WrestleMania so far has been played perfectly. I really enjoy watching these shows and watching the little storyline twists and turns. And that's really what WrestleMania should be all about. And they're doing it long in advance. I mean, the road to WrestleMania now has been winding for many, many weeks now. And it's good to see them give some degree of long-term thought to what they're going to do on the biggest show of the year. I like that. I like it a lot. So those are my thoughts on Raw. I really like that last segment. I don't know when Bret will be back. If I had to take a guess, I think next week is too soon to have Bret come back unless they do something where he comes and Vince doesn't let him in or something. I would think that Bret would be on Raw the week after this upcoming Monday, but I don't know that for sure. I know the only thing we know about Raw this Monday is the triple threat match for the tag belts, and that we have another NASCAR driver, Carl Edwards, as guest host, so that's going to be a complete waste. I think Jerry Springer is the guest host for the week after that, which is President's Day. That should be interesting, if nothing else. I know Cheech and Chong are hosting the show on March 1st. I think March 8th is Chris Angel, who has that show, Mind Freak. I think they also announced that Ty Law, or whatever the hell his name is, and Jewel, who apparently are married, are going to be that. I mean, that's going to be an epic waste. Stone Cold Steve Austin will be on Raw March 15th to promote his DVD Damage. I don't know if Austin will have a role in WrestleMania. I guess not, but, you know, it's 2 weeks before WrestleMania, so maybe they will, maybe they'll announce something. I don't know. And those are my thoughts for Raw. That pretty much wraps that part of the report up. Nothing really new to report on the Impact front. I believe Impact is going to go full time on Monday, starting sometime in March. I think they have a live show planned for March 1st. They took it off the schedule, Spike TV did, but I think that's just because TNA wants to be the ones to make the announcement. So, I guess we'll see, but nothing has been confirmed. I know Impact on Thursday was down to a 1.2. They had done a 1.4 last week, and I know that the people in TNA were not happy when that TV rating came in on, well, I guess it would have been yesterday, on Friday afternoon, so... what that means, I don't know, but I think it's pretty much preordained at this point. I think they're going live full-time to Monday nights, and or at least live every other week. And we shall see if that's the smart move or not. I think it is. If I was TNA, if I was Eric Bischoff, if I'm Spike TV, I say go for it. You know, the worst thing that happens is TNA moves to Monday nights, they get squashed, and so they move back to Thursdays. You know, but you don't know unless you take the risk. And I think... the experiment on January 4th proved that TNA has at least a shot to be semi-competitive with WWE on Monday nights and not get their clock clean. So, you know, I'm looking forward to it. We'll see if it happens on March 1st, as is the current plan. Japanese legend Antonio Inoki being inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame on March 27th. This was confirmed by the WWE's own Japanese website, but WWE.com and WWE on Raw and SmackDown this week made no mention of it, so I will say that it is not 100% confirmed until we hear it on TV, but it was the WWE's own Japanese website, apparently, that reported it, that Inoki would be inducted, and he would be inducted by Stan Hansen, another famous American mainstay in Japan. I know Hansen is one of those big brutes. He had some battles over the years with people like Big Van Vader and I think he had matches with Bruiser Brody in the 80s before Brody was murdered. I'm not sure. But, you know, other than that, nothing new on the Hall of Fame. I think I mentioned last week that Honky Tonk Man declined an invitation into the Hall of Fame this year, so he will not be going into the Hall of Fame. And he's not going into TNA either because... all those rumors that he was floating on his own website about that were pretty much squashed when Eric Bischoff went on Bubba the Love Sponge last week and said that Honky Tonk Man could not draw flies if you rolled him in bullshit. Honky Tonk Man, by the way, did not take that very kindly, and he is supposedly going to pursue legal action against Eric Bischoff. You know, good luck with that. And I guess the last piece of big news for this week is that it finally happened. Vince McMahon came out on ECW Tuesday night and made the announcement that ECW will be no more as of February 23rd. That will be the start date for their new show on Sci-Fi called WWE NXT, which I guess stands for Next Generation somehow. WWE NXT, which is interesting because as people have pointed out to me, there is actually a wrestling, kind of an independent wrestling promotion in, I think, Scotland called NXT. So I think WWE filed the patent or the copyright, whatever it is for the show. I don't know that it was approved. I would hope so, since they're already putting advertisements out there with this NXT logo on it. Nobody really knows what form this show is going to take. We know there's going to be young guys on there. I don't know if it will literally be full of new talent from FCW, or if they're still going to mix in veterans like Christian and Goldust and people like that. I don't, you know, the plan as I heard it was, it would be completely about young new guys that have not been exposed on TV. And guys from the ECW brand like Christian, at long last, would be shifted over to the other brands like SmackDown. They actually have not determined what would happen with the ECW title, which just makes me laugh. You're killing the ECW brand, but you're going to keep a belt that says ECW on it? That makes no sense to me whatsoever. Just get rid of the fucking belt. You have enough belts. You don't need it. It's ugly anyway. Anyway, back to this NXT show. What they're trying to figure out is the format that it's going to take. So from what I've read, from what I've heard, you know, and listening to other, you know, shows and the newsletters and all that stuff, and Meltzer and Keller and Alvarez and all those people, is that they're interested in some sort of reality show type format. It almost sounds to me like the old Tough Enough show, where not that you're going to take these guys and put them in a house and the winner gets a contract, but just that these new guys are going to have matches, they're going to be featured, but there's going to be sort of these reality-type segments. Maybe almost like the UFC, you know, kind of countdown hype specials. That actually would not be a horrible idea, you know, to get people familiar with who these guys are, you know. Don't just throw them out there with a name and some ridiculous gimmick. Explain to us their background. Tell us who they are, where they come from. Bryan Danielson may be the centerpiece of this show. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I know people like Danielson are down in FCW. Caval, who used to be known as Low Key, as the former Ring of Honor champion, and for those of you TNA fans, he used to be the X Division champion, Senshi. He's now called Caval. At least that's his name in FCW. I don't know if he may change his name when he comes up to TV, but I am intrigued. Color me intrigued by this idea. I'm going to watch NXT that first night. Now, if I'm out at the gym, and actually I probably will be, I'll be sure to tape it and watch it when I get back, because I'm very intrigued to see how they handle this new show. But yes, ECW will officially be no more. I guess February 16th will be the final ECW show. And, you know, let's be honest, ECW proper has been dead for many years. It's not really that big of a deal, I guess, but, you know, it's still in many ways is the end of an era. The end of those three very popular initials. And we'll see where they go from here. Obviously, ECW was not working for Sci-Fi. You know, ratings had plummeted from where they were when ECW first started as a brand. I think that first show drew like a 2.7. And their shows now average anywhere from a 0.9 to a 1.1. Usually it's a 0.9 or a 1.0, which is still pretty good for a cable show. But again, it's not great. Sci-Fi has plenty of shows that do better than that. So that is the story on the demise of ECW. And you may remember, I reported it on this podcast last year. I said that sometime after the new year, ECW was going to be no more. I actually answered a question on the last show, I think, or was it 2 weeks ago in the mailbag? Somebody asked me. They said, Solomoser, when is it going to take place? And I said I hadn't heard anything, and that maybe they were going to wait until after WrestleMania, but I guess they decided that we can't afford to wait until after WrestleMania, and it's going to happen this month. So there you go. All right, so let's get into some mailbag questions here. So I unfasten this fat bastard here. Got a lot of letters waiting for me. Actually, just got one that came in from a longtime listener here who apparently created his own custom Solomonster Sounds Off Firefox browser skin. That sounds immensely frightening. I have to check this out after. If it's worthwhile, I may just link to it on my Twitter page. So watch for it there. Maybe I'll link up so people who want to download a Solomonster skin for their browser can do so. All right, just got a question in from somebody on their BlackBerry. With Edge winning the Royal Rumble, does this completely change the planned WrestleMania card? I don't know that it completely changes the entire WrestleMania card. I mean, if they still want to do Edge and Chris Jericho, you can very easily have Jericho win the title in the Elimination Chamber match at the pay-per-view, and then have Edge. I mean, it would make Edge's decision academic as far as which champion he would choose for WrestleMania, and then he can choose Chris Jericho and just make Edge and Jericho a title match, which may not be the worst idea in the world, quite frankly. So I don't see where it really messes up too much. If anything, it just makes things that much more unpredictable, which I like, because things in WWE for far too long now have been very paint-by-numbers, by-the-book, very predictable. And I trust that with WrestleMania this year, they know what they're doing, and we don't know what direction they're going in, and I think that's a good thing. Let's see here. Dear Solomonster, I could not think of another black holder of the WWE Championship since The Rock. And by WWE title, I do not mean the World Heavyweight title or the ECW title. We may be wrong. Me and my friend, and I was hoping that you would know, has there been an African-American WWE champion since The Great One? Who, by the way, was only part black. So, you know, if you're, well, I won't get into that, but He's part African-American and part Samoan. So, but I guess technically you could say The Rock is black. And yes, he was WWE champion 7 times. Since then, we've seen people like Booker T be the world heavyweight champion. He was a former WCW champion, of course. I don't believe so. I mean, Mark Henry held the ECW title. Obviously, that doesn't count. I guess he was. I guess we have not had another black champion since The Rock. So there you go. I can't think of any. I mean, certainly if I'm wrong, I'm sure people will email me and let me know. Dear Solomonster, what was your favorite year in wrestling? Mine was 1999. What was yours and why? That comes from Brian in upstate New York. My favorite wrestling year was one from my youth. I had already been a wrestling fan for many years at that point, but it would be 1992. I just love 1992 WWF. I really do. Obviously, they weren't doing nearly the amount of business they would do later in the 90s, but to me as a kid, that didn't matter. I didn't give a shit about that. I just watched the product on TV, and I either liked it or I didn't. And, for example, just a couple of years later in 1995, I think it was February of 95, I came as close as I ever have in my life to just completely dropping out as a wrestling fan and just not watching wrestling anymore, because that's, and I was always a WWF fan. I grew up in the Northeast. I was a WWF fan. That's all I, at that time, I was familiar with WCW. I would watch WCW Saturday night when I would go to my grandparents' house and they had TBS there, but I would watch WWF and that was it. And 1995 was a fucking piss poor year to be a WWF fan. Just atrocious. But in 92, it was the complete and polar opposite. And, you know, the year started with the Royal Rumble. I said it before, the 1992 Royal Rumble match. As a pay-per-view, if you look at it as a pay-per-view, I mean, the rest of the card was largely forgettable, although you did have a Roddy Piper Intercontinental title win over the Mountie, which was historic in that, you know, Piper had already been around for quite some time, but had never held a title in WWF until that night. But the Rumble match in 92 and Ric Flair's performance and Bobby Heenan on commentary and, you know, for all this talk about how star-studded the Rumble was this year, I gotta tell you, the 1992 Rumble, if you look at the people who were in it, even for that time period in terms of the stars at that time, but let alone looking back on it all these years later, it had Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, Sid Justice, Undertaker, Sergeant Slaughter, Shawn Michaels, Kerry Von Erich, who once upon a time was a very big star. Roddy Piper, who had won the Intercontinental belt earlier that night and was trying to win the WWF belt. Because again, the unique thing about the 92 Rumble was the fact that for the first and only time in history, I'm shocked that they have not done this since then, but now that you have more than one belt, I don't see how it's possible. The title was vacant, and it was actually up for grabs in the Rumble match. That was really cool. WrestleMania 8, to me, is one of the more underrated shows. It wasn't a great show from top to bottom, but I liked a lot of the stuff on there. I thought the Hoosier Dome was a great setting for a show, 60,000 people. You had Bret Hart and Roddy Piper, and to this day, to me, what is the greatest singles match Roddy Piper has ever been in, on TV anyway. You had Undertaker and Jake the Snake, which, as a match, was not great, but I liked it. For some reason, I really liked that match. And you had a really good WWF Championship match between Randy Savage and Ric Flair. Again, I think many times we'll get the shaft because Ric Flair has had hundreds of great matches in his career. This one, I think, gets overlooked quite a bit. It was certainly better than any Savage-Flair match I ever saw in WCW. So WrestleMania 8, to me, was 2 thumbs up. SummerSlam 92. To this day, it's probably the biggest SummerSlam of all time. Wembley Stadium, London, England, a legit 80,000 people, I think, well, I think it was technically 79,000, but it was legit. It was legit the biggest crowd in WWE history. If you are one of those people who believes the 93,000 figure for WrestleMania 3 was inflated from 78,000, then yes, SummerSlam 92 is, in that respect, the biggest WWF show of all time. Bret Hart and Bulldog had one of the all-time great matches. I thought Randy Savage and the Ultimate Warrior had a great match that night. Yes, that Ultimate Warrior. Somehow, Savage was always able to bring the best out of him when they had big-time matches on TV. And then Survivor Series 92 was probably, I probably ranked that at the bottom in terms of the pay-per-views that year, but what we got out of it, because a lot of things were going on in the WWF at that point in terms of big stars who were leaving or who were not quite as big as they used to be, cracking down on steroids, for example, was happening just around that time period. WWF was getting legitimately strict about their drug policy. You know, British Bulldog, for example, and Ultimate Warrior, who were going to be integral parts of the Survivor Series pay-per-view, were both fired from the WWF about within weeks of the Survivor Series pay-per-view. Bret Hart won the belt. His first WWF championship happened the month before. It was a big shocker. It was a, it was actually a non-televised match in Canada. Bret beat Ric Flair, won the belt. Shawn Michaels had beaten the Bulldog on Saturday night's main event later that month to become the Intercontinental Champion. And we got our first big-time Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels singles match, which was probably better than any Bret-Shawn match that I ever saw after that. It was that Survivor Series match in 1992. Just a great, great main event. You know, a lot of the angles and storylines going back to WrestleMania that year, the whole Miss Elizabeth with Ric Flair, Mr. Perfect, you know, she was mine before she was yours, and I just really like 1992. If I had to pick a second year, I'd probably say 1998, because let's be honest, 98 was a fun year to be a wrestling fan. WWF, WCW, whatever it was, if you were a fan of Goldberg, if you were a fan of Hogan in the NWO, Stone Cold, Austin vs. McMahon, DX, The Rock, 1998 was a coming of age for the wrestling industry in this country. And they did pretty good TV ratings, too, around that time period. So I'd say 1992 and then probably 1998 would be my second pick. So if I had to pick a number three to round off a top three, I'd probably say 2000. I think 2000 was a really good year, too. Not so much for WCW, but for WWF, it's a year that, you know, The Rock and Triple H in particular really stepped. Triple H became a man that year. He became a legit main event guy, thanks in large part to Mick Foley, putting him over so strongly at the beginning of the year. But Rock and Triple H really carried the load well that year, while Stone Cold was on the shelf with that neck injury. So those would be my rankings. Let's see here. Dear Solomon, sir, I was just playing with my Ouija board, and I asked it if Vince McMahon will face Bret Hart at WrestleMania 26. It said yes. I would like it if you can please include this in your next sound off so that I could say, I told you so. Well, there you go. And really, though, you needed a Ouija board to tell you that? Really now? Really? Adam writes in, Dear Solomonster, I was watching the Royal Rumble and noticed the Undertaker was bleeding. I was wondering if the reason they didn't bother to clean it up was because it was to the nose and they really can't do anything besides wipe his face, or if it was because it was the Undertaker, or perhaps they've given up on stopping matches due to blood. Well, they have not, as far as I know, stopped matches due to blood, or rather have gotten rid of that. They're still very strict about that. I noticed that Matt Hardy was also bleeding from the mouth, although not as much as the Undertaker. He was bleeding from the face on SmackDown, and not only did they show it and not stop the match, but Matt Stryker even referenced it at one point. So I think it's just, if it's something minor like that, I mean, to these guys, some blood from the mouth, blood from the nose, not a big deal. It's far different than having your head busted open, for example, and blood pouring down your face. I just think it's not a major thing, and so they just said, fuck it, there's nothing we can really do about it. Just let them wipe it away and just continue the match, not a big deal. So that's pretty much all that was. I mean, I don't think it was Undertaker getting preferential treatment or anything. There's just only so much they can do. What are they going to do? Stop the match? I mean, when they stopped the Christian Shelton Benjamin match a couple months ago at TLC, it completely killed the momentum of the match. But that was a much more serious wound than the Undertaker sustained at the Royal Rumble. Dear Solomonster, I'm sorry if you're already aware of this, but it's really quite interesting nonetheless. It seems that second place in the Royal Rumble gets an opportunity to challenge at WrestleMania 2. Here is the pattern. 2005, Batista eliminates John Cena to win the Royal Rumble. WrestleMania 21, Batista and Cena are in their respective main events. 2006, Rey Mysterio eliminates Randy Orton to win the Royal Rumble. At WrestleMania 22, Mysterio and Orton are both involved in the SmackDown main event. 2007, Undertaker eliminates Shawn Michaels to win the Rumble. At WrestleMania 23 that year, Undertaker and Michaels are in their respective championship main events. 2008, John Cena eliminates Triple H to win the Royal Rumble. WrestleMania 24 that year, Cena and Triple H are both involved in the Raw main event. 2009, Orton eliminates Triple H to win the Rumble. And at WrestleMania 25, both of them are involved in the Raw title match. I did not realize that. This is the first I'm actually seeing it in print and realizing that pattern, which actually is very interesting. Now, He goes on to say here, no doubt John Cena will main event WrestleMania 26, which would make 6 years of tedious hell. Is this an established pattern that I'm too slow to pick up on, or is WWE just using some kind of Royal Rumble ready mix formula? You know what? I don't think it's a formula. I just think it, you know, they've developed so few new top stars over the years. These are the guys that you would expect to be in the main event every single year anyway. It's a very interesting pattern. I never really looked at it like that, but I will say that I think you're wrong. I think this year, the streak, so to speak, will be over, because I do not see John Cena being involved in either championship match. Now, if Cena Batista, let's say, tag up with Bret and Vince, and they decide to put that match on last, then yes, you can say that John Cena once again, you know, main event of WrestleMania, but I don't see John Cena in that position this year. I guess we'll just have to see, but that is a very interesting pattern. I just did not notice that before. Alright, let's see here. Dear Solomonster, first, I love the podcast. My week is not complete without it. Well, thank you. There is a question that nobody has seemed to ask that really surprises me about the whole Bret Hart storyline. I didn't think he was able to ever wrestle again, even if he wanted to, because of his insurance claim for his career-ending injury. I even saw a Shoot interview a few years ago, and he actually mentioned this. Surely there would be some sort of legal repercussions if he was to turn up and wrestle Vince or even fight Vince in some way at Mania. Wouldn't it void his policy or pay out? Please, Solomonster, I know you can shed some light on this. Well, nobody knows for sure but Bret, because that's between him and his insurance company, which I believe was Lloyd's of London, and my guess is that the policy or whatever it was may have expired. It either expired or there was some sort of issue, because now that you mention that, I remember that Bret had some sort of issue. It may have been with Lloyd's of London and may have even filed a lawsuit against them because they didn't want to pay or something, and I think Bret won. I don't know if that is something completely different or if that's the situation, but you're right. If Bret was going to get physical in any way, even like he did on Monday night, quite frankly, let alone actually compete in a match at WrestleMania, if he was under a policy like that, that would cause some very serious issues. I'm sure that Bret knows this, and he's not going to agree to something unless, you know, he's not in that situation, obviously. So, you know, but it is certainly a valid question. There's been a lot of, not easy for a wrestler to get insurance these days, and I know there's been issues over the years with, wrestlers like Kurt Hennig, who had a Lloyd's of London policy, and, that's why he was out of action for so long in the mid-90s after that back injury. Rick Rude, I believe, had a policy with them as well, and many others as well. So that's the situation there. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm fairly certain that whatever policy Bret may have been under, he is no longer under it, for whatever the reasons are. Let's see. Tim writes in here with an interesting little factoid, Solomonster. I thought I would pass this along. I live in Joliet, Illinois. I hope I pronounced that right. And I got a flyer on a pizza box, nonetheless, that is advertising pro wrestling at the VFW by my house. And who do I see on the flyer? Road Dogg and Billy Gunn set to appear. What a fall from grace for those two. The best part is that they are using DX and the New Age Outlaws to promote it. I wonder what would Vince think of that? Anyways, I thought about going just to harass Road Dogg with offers of heroin. I know it's not nice, but at least I would be entertained by it. The promotion is Pro Wrestling Blitz, just so you know. Yeah, I would not go to harass Road Dogg. First of all, Road Dogg has, by all accounts, successfully battled whatever demons he had. He seems to be doing well enough. He's been doing some agent work for TNA recently. I wouldn't go harass the guy. But, you know, you call it a fall from grace. True, Road Dogg and Billy Gunn at one point were very, very popular and very, very successful. They were part of DX. They were worldwide, well-known. I wouldn't call it exactly a fall from grace. Road Dogg is in his 40s. Billy Gunn is in his 40s. If he's not, he's damn close. And it's arguable that Billy Gunn was ever any good, to be honest with you. King of the Ring 1999, what a fucking joke that was. But, you know, if it was a guy like a Bruno Sammartino or a Hulk Hogan or a Randy Savage or a Bret Hart on a pizza box going to your show at the local VFW, well then, yeah, you can call it a fall from grace. Road Dogg and Billy Gunn, is it really that much of a fall? Really? Maybe they fell off the third rung of the ladder. I don't know about the top. So, anyway. Got a letter here from Chris in Romania. By the way, that reminds me. I've been tracking. the downloads for the podcast. And I've talked before about how we have people from all over the world who listen to this show, which is great. I think, you know, the majority obviously come from the States. They come from North America, the States and Canada. But we have plenty of people from Mexico and different places in Europe. And I've noticed an increase in the number of different countries. So, for example, you know, a couple of different ones this past week that popped up were Portugal. Romania was actually one. In fact, it may have been Chris. Australia, New Zealand. I think Belgium was another one I noticed. France, Germany, Italy, Poland was one I noticed. Japan, I'm pretty sure India, not this past week, I think that was the week before, and there was another country that escapes me now, it might have been Switzerland. So this podcast is truly global, and it just boggles my mind that we have people halfway around the world who I've never met a day in my life and will likely never meet because they live halfway around the world in a country I've never been to in my entire life, probably a completely different culture. Listening to this show because of one common thread. We're all wrestling fans. We're all a bunch of sick bastards. We're all wrestling fans. And I think that's really cool. So anyway, this is Chris's first email. We're popping his mailbag cherry here, if you will. And it's a very long letter, so I'm not going to get into all of it. But the gist of it is he's a very big CM Punk fan and feels that Punk certainly has the potential to main event a WrestleMania. He could see Punk main eventing a WrestleMania against a John Cena, Triple H, Shawn Michaels. I think that Punk is going to be long-term a main event guy in WWE, the likes of a Randy Orton or an Edge or a John Cena. It may take a couple years for him to get there where he is solidly in the main event all the time, but he will get there because he's that good and he's already been there. He's already tasted what it's like. He's already been a 3-time straight edge world champion. And there's plenty of feuds for him. Punk and Shawn Michaels, I think, would be a great feud. Now, interesting little factoid here that I read from a reliable source who I get news from every week. It was just a very brief mention, but it struck me because, you know, it's not the sort of thing you think about. But apparently, right now in WWE, Shawn Michaels is not very infatuated with CM Punk. And the reason is he's not a big fan of Punk's savior character on TV because, again, Shawn Michaels is a devout Christian. He's a religious man. He's a family man now. Very different than the Shawn Michaels of a decade or 15 years ago. And there are certain things, even though he's in DX doing, you know, stupid juvenile things all the time. And I guess when things get a little too juvenile, Triple H will always send Shawn Michaels away like he's a little child. But Shawn, you know, he takes offense to certain things like that. You know, you won't hear him using types of language, for example, that he used many, many years ago. If he does, he'll probably be in church all day on Sunday. So apparently Shawn is not a fan of CM Punk's character. Now, I don't think that means that they're going to force Punk to change or drop his character, but it's just worth noting that Shawn is not a big fan of it. What that means for Punk, I don't know. But hopefully Shawn will turn the other cheek as a good Christian and Punk can, you know, Punk can continue on because I really like what he's doing right now on SmackDown. I'd love to see Punk and Shawn in a feud. I think Punk and Cena, who have had a match or two here and there, but they've never had a real feud. I think that would be really cool. And really, Punk and Cena, they're characters of the polar opposites. I think that would make that feud work, quite frankly. Punk and Triple H, I don't want to see, and I think we can guess for all the right reasons why I don't want to see that feud, because there's only one outcome to it, let's be honest. Punk and Edge, I can see that. Punk and Orton, absolutely. Maybe when Orton, if Orton at some point goes babyface, sure. Punk and Undertaker, we've already seen. But there's countless possibilities here. Even when people like Bryan Danielson and some of the guys in developmental are finally brought up to TV, you know, I think it would be great to mix Punk in there with them. The rumor right now is that Punk and Rey Mysterio may have a program set up for WrestleMania. Maybe they may have a mask versus hair match. I've heard a lot about that. You know, if I had to take a guess, if they're going to have that match at WrestleMania, something has to happen between Punk and Mysterio at the Elimination Chamber because there's been no interaction really between the two of them. There has to be a spark for that feud, and I think if it comes, they're both in that chamber match with Undertaker, that would be the place to watch for it. So I guess we'll see, but Chris, the big Punk fan in Romania, feels very passionately about Punk's future in WWE, and you know what? I can't say that I blame him because he really is. He's a really talented guy who worked his way up from the indies, made a name for himself there. The odds of an indie guy coming to WWE and becoming a big success, let's be honest, slim and none. It happens, but it doesn't happen very often at all. Punk is one of the few exceptions, and I'm really happy for him. Bill writes in here, it's apparent that Michael Cole is not much of a sports fan. I don't know if you caught it or not, but at the Royal Rumble, he said, and he's paraphrasing here, it's like our All-Star game, but our stars are playing for something. Now, I'm sure that he got the All-Star game and the NFL Pro Bowl mixed up. I just thought that it was humorous nonetheless. Well, Michael Cole fucking up an analogy. Really. I am, color me flabbergasted by that development. And by the way, Bill makes a really good point because, you know, the All-Star game in baseball now actually means quite a bit. The winner helps their league secure home field advantage in the World Series, which can make or break a team. The Pro Bowl, typically in the NFL, which I think this is the first year they moved it before the Super Bowl, usually it's after the Super Bowl and nobody gives a shit about it. The Pro Bowl actually scored big ratings this year. The Pro Bowl, as compared to the All-Star game, really doesn't mean much at all. So, yeah, Michael Cole fucking up a sports analogy. Well, won't be the first time. Won't be the last time. Let's just be honest here. It's par for the course with Michael Cole. I hate to pile on the guy in one podcast, but this week, I'm sorry. He deserves it. He's awful. Let's see. Jamie in Niagara Falls. Solomonster, do you think WWE would be more successful with their pay-per-view buy rates if they held their pay-per-views on Monday nights as opposed to their regular programming? Hard to say. I'm gonna say no, just because, you know, Monday night is a work night, it's a school night. I just don't think it's a good night to organize pay-per-view parties, for example, and pay-per-view gatherings, which people still do, on the weekends. But what's interesting here is it's not completely ridiculous to think of a WWF pay-per-view on a Monday night. They used to have pay-per-views on Monday nights. In fact, even during the Raw era, which I don't really remember much about that because I didn't get cable until 95. So the Raw shows I saw from 93 to 95 were selective because I had somebody tape it for me and I would watch them, but it wasn't every week. But I do know, for example, that SummerSlam in 1993, that August, which emanated from the Palace of Auburn Hills in Auburn Hills, Michigan, I could remember that, but I can't remember matches I saw 2 weeks ago on television. Go figure. SummerSlam that year in 93, which, again, Raw was on the air, was on a Monday night. I guess, obviously, Raw was preempted that night. Why it was on a Monday night, I don't know. There were pay-per-views before then that were on, you know, Saturday nights, for example, I think, or Sundays. But, yeah, there were pay-per-views, even as late as 1993, airing on Monday nights. Obviously, they did not do that well, because if they did well, they would have kept the pay-per-views on Mondays, and they did not do that. So that answers that question. And lastly, back to my buddy Bill. This was an email I wanted to mention before when he submitted his other one, but this goes back to last week on the podcast. It was talking about trademarks and whatnot. And Bill writes in, just to give you a heads up, unlike copyrights and patents, trademarks are indefinitely enforced. This was, by the way, the question that somebody asked last week about the War Games trademark that WWE has, and when and if it were to expire, could somebody come up and snatch it? Anyway, Bill continues, however, trademarks must be renewed with the USPO every 10 years, and the WWE attorneys have to be vigilant about updating their various trademarks, which include those from WCW and ECW, with the USPO, because, unlike with domain names, companies are not given a friendly reminder that their renewal period is closely approaching, or even worse, lapsed. However, if the WWE legal team fails to renew their trademark, they are given a 6-month grace period where they can refile and submit a filing fee to the USPO. Just thought that you'd like that bit of completely useless information. Well, nothing that you ever send in is useless, because that's something I didn't even know. I'm not big on copyrights and patents and trademarks, although I should be. There you go. And as far as WWE legal is concerned, I can tell you, I can definitely tell you with the utmost confidence, they don't fall behind the eight ball on too many different things. They're very up on what's going on. They're not going to allow something like WCW trademarks to expire and let some other wrestling organization snatch them up. So anybody hoping that in 5 or 10 years TNA may have a War Games match and call it that ain't going to happen. So don't hold your breath. So that's going to do it. I'm going to cinch up this mailbag here. And if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, fan mail, hate mail, anything like that, thesolomonster@gmail.com is the email address. It has been for the past 99 episodes, and it will be next week as well. or the week after, whenever it may be that we have episode 100, which is quickly approaching. Like I said before, follow me on Twitter if you're not doing it already. Please follow me there, twitter.com/solomonster. I will have an update for you at some point during the week as far as when the show will be, what my plans are, if it's just going to be a regular show or if I'm going to do it live and I want to give you guys a chance to call in. I'll let you know the date. I'll let you know the time. I'll you know, let you know where and when. But you got to follow me on Twitter because obviously that's the only way to keep up on what's going on during the week when there's no podcast. So do follow me there. I don't know exactly when the 100th show will be, live or otherwise. I'm guessing at some point next weekend, but I don't know that for a fact. It could be the week after, depending on what's going on. Whenever it is, though, I'm looking forward to it because, let's be honest here, even if it is a regular show, it's still a milestone. It means a lot to me. It may not mean a lot to you guys, but it means a lot to me. Because I started this as a favor to a friend for his website and as a labor of love, which I continue to do it for that very same reason. But I didn't know I was going to hit 100 episodes and who knows how many more there'll be. You know, there could be another 100. There could be 5 more. Anything's possible. But for everybody who has listened to this show from day one, thank you. I don't know what else to say. If you've listened from the very first episode, from the first 5 episodes, even if you've only been listening since episode 80, if you take the time out of your week, an hour, or in this case, an hour and 20 minutes, we've gone long here, but whatever it may be, taking that time out of your day to listen to me talk about wrestling, it really does mean a lot to me. More than I can even put into words. So I thank you, I salute you, and I do hope that when the 100th episode does take place very soon, that you will find time to be part of that as well. And I'm looking forward to it. We already have the new logo up. I was going to wait until the 100th episode to start embedding it with the MP3s, but I already started with it. It's a little more edgy, you know, and I got that little podcast logo in there. So you got to love the little microphone. So, yeah, anyway, new logo and a new era here for the Sound Off on SEScoops.com. And, yeah, I'd be remiss. I'll say it next week, too, but I give a big shout-out and a thanks to my buddy Mike, who runs SEScoops and gives me the opportunity to post this podcast on his site and reach all of the SEScoops fans every single week. It's a website that's growing by leaps and bounds. Of course, Fight Scoops is the sister site as well, and doing really good stuff. It really is your portal to wrestling news from all over the web. It kind of brings it together in one place, so you don't have to visit 5 or 10 different wrestling websites. You just come to one place and get all the news, and you get this podcast. What more could you possibly ask for? So anyway, thank you guys. Follow me on Twitter. I'll have updates there about episode 100, and that's going to do it for episode 99 this week. Enjoy Raw this upcoming Monday night with Carl Edwards as the guest host. Road to WrestleMania rolls on. And until next time, as always, be well. Especially stay safe if you're in the East Coast dealing with the snowstorm. I don't want to be one or two listeners short if there's any accidents out there. So do be safe. And when we see you next time, it will be time to celebrate. Take it easy, guys.
You've been listening to The Sama Monster.
You know, I really just don't understand what they're doing. Anybody agree with me out there? I mean, anybody. Come on, throw me a bone here. Probably the single dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. God, I love this business. On SEScoops.com.